Всем добро и фирмы. Совместно мы
нужны. Mutual Gambling came back and repealed that measure. Today we're being asked to forget those lessons of history and to once again rely on pari-mutuel gambling to bail us out of financial difficulties. I would submit to you, members, that this is an industry that's built on illusion and hype. And the records of other states would suggest that the promises are illusory. It is not the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow that its proponents suggest. Let me very briefly contrast the hype that we have heard in the last few weeks and months on this issue with some of the realities. We're told that this is the sport of kings. Somehow it's been vested with nobility. And yet the reality of it is that horse racing is a predatory industry. It's based on the fact that there are always more losers than winners. The social costs of gambling, if you examine carefully the results in other states, are devastating in the creation of literally addicts to impoverishing people who already are living at the margins. I would suggest to you that it is the most regressive tax of all. I would suggest as well that this is one of those things over which as many public officials have been corrupted than any other area of public policy. I can only recall three governors in this century who have gone to prison. And two of those governors went to prison over pari-mutuel gambling. Those were Otto Kerner, recently in Illinois, and Governor Mandel in Maryland. We're the handle that we're going to be bailed out of our economic difficulties. But I would suggest to you that the facts show that if we pass this bill, we're hitching our wagon to a falling star. That this is, in fact, a dying industry. It's dying all over the country. The handle is down in practically every state. The revenue produced from pari-mutuel gambling increased steadily until 1976, and in terms of inflation-adjusted dollars, has gone down since that time. Is that really the economic bailout?
It's been. When in fact the statistics point out very clearly that on the average amount of money spent at the racetrack or bet at the racetrack is $81 per year, which clearly points out that this is a big spectator sport for horse racing enthusiasts. We've had horse racing in Texas for many, many, many years. The only thing that we have not been able to do is to allow people to wager on it. There's been a lot of wagering done on these bush tracks, side bets. Again, I think that it's ironic how now the proponents are asking that the people of this state not be given an opportunity to vote. And the reason that is because they see the polls and they can read polls just like anyone else.
And Mr. Speaker,
the polls clearly change.
Mr. Long, you yield, Mr. Willis?
I will not yield at this time, Mr.
Speaker. The gentleman does not yield at this time, Mr. Willis.
I want him to yield before he quits, Mr. Speaker.
...that are trying to be achieved with the provisions. I am moving to be strict. I realize the risk, frankly, that I run to appear anti-minority, but I will have to leave my reputation and my personal relationships with each of you to judge that. It is not anti-minority. It is pro-Texas. It is what is good for
Ms. Oliver. Continue.
It is what is good for all Texans. Rather than to perpetuate the idea that I am different because I am a minority, I seek to have all venture capitalists, all contractors, all men and women eligible to participate on their merits, not on the color of their skin. I am confident that there will be participation by all citizens without these provisions in the law. Provisions that raise serious
It's my posture that if we're going to pass a bill, a horse racing bill, it ought to benefit all the citizens of the state. We're concerned that some provision be made in the bill to take care of the needs of poor children in some form or fashion. The proponents of the bill did not want to consider that, did not want to negotiate with us on that regard, and so we opposed it.
But the attempts to remove the minority provisions failed, but apparently it still wasn't good enough.
Well, you see, the minority provisions that were included in the bill didn't mean anything. It was language that was meaningless. And we weren't going to be tricked by it. See, that's why we voted against it.
Who were the coalitions voting against this thing? It seems like, I guess, the conservatives also voted against it because of the minority provisions.
I'm not sure. I have to look at that vote, the final vote, but I'm not really sure.
What do you think in the end doomed it?
I think that the organizers that were pushing the bill just didn't have their act together. They may have been a little bit too confident, a little bit too cocky.
This is basically over for this session again, unless the Senate side sends something over?
I don't think so. I think the Senate will send a bill over. I think they'll go back and regroup, and we'll see a better bill come out. I don't think horse racing is dead by any means, no.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Well, the resolution adds weight to what a number of other states are already doing. I think it's South Dakota that has its entire legislature in Washington. We're a little too busy to do that here in Texas, and I don't expect that we're all ready to fly to Washington to lobby. But we want to lend weight to what other states are doing and are hopeful that what's called for in the resolution, that is positive action by Congress on the 1985 Farm Bill, will be the result. I'm sure he can, and I'd be glad. Hagan, if you'd come down where the mics are. Sure.
In Texas, we have 1,800 banks domiciled here in the state. Out of that number, we have 1,278 independent banks that are, a good number of those banks are involved in agricultural lending. This is an age of deregulation. The thrust has been put on banks, on airlines, a lot of industry, and now it's coming down on the farming community. I think what we have to suggest is that there has to be a long weaning process, not just an abrupt cutoff of the farming or the banking industry. Approximately 500 of the banks that we represent in Texas are agricultural banks involved in this lending, and out of that number of banks, several of these banks have 3 and 4 year carryovers on loans that have not performed, 1981 crop loans. So we do need some regulatory relief, and I think what this press conference and what the legislature is doing today is bringing that to the attention of Congress. And you know, we live in a great state that is booming, quote unquote, but that X's out the farming community. You know, industry wise, the Sun Belt industry, high tech, is very strong, but our agricultural industry is really hurting. So we're asking not only for regulatory relief, but for Congress to take notice on the problems, not only that the farmers and ranchers have, but what the financial institutions in those communities are also experiencing. Well, the state can certainly help in supporting some sort of relief through congressional action. What I'm talking about, regulatory relief, are the regulators that regulate our industry, control the currency, FDIC, the various, the Federal Reserve, the State Banking Department, that examine these banks and have the opportunity to look at these loans and determine whether they are performing or non-performing, and if there's light at the end of the tunnel. So, you know, to get a loan classified and written off the bank will not solve the solution. We saw several bank failures in Texas, 9 that I can think of last year. They were all agricultural related. No, I think this is nationwide. I think it's the farm prices. I think the West Texas Panhandle area has been severely hindered. I think South Texas, the area that was frozen last year, is an area. I think the drought that we had in the Uvalde area on over to West Texas, the Big Bend area, severely hurt the ranching communities that had to sell off their herds. They just could not feed them.
Have you just diplomatically said you want the federal government to pick up the bad loans and bail out the banks?
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that we would like to keep a large number of those on the books as far as and not charge those off. You know, have a definite workout situation, some regulatory relief in that area.
How much of the, specifically what are the American Farm Movement's proposals are y'all behind as far as the debt relief?
I would say that the Independent Bankers Association of America is behind a lot of this legislation and has helped draft some of the legislation. I don't have the final proposals that they are recommending, and I might add that they're meeting in San Antonio this week for a national convention and plan to come out with several adopted recommendations for the agricultural area.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, something like debt consolidation at lower interest rates and stuff like that, or taking care of some of these two or three loans, consolidating them, lower interest?
I'm not prepared to answer that this time until they really come out with their consensus, and I'd rather defer to them.
We have a number of other people that Mr. McMahon will be available after the news conference, I'm sure. We have a number of other people that we'd like to get before you talk a little bit about some problems they have specifically in their areas. I'd like to recognize Rick Perry here from Hassel, who has a number of constituents, and they have some special interests in agriculture. Rick, can you tell us about the folks you have here that are great reference people for this?
Just by incident today, we have our hometown day, which is Hassel County Day, and there's not a lady or gentleman standing over there in the corner that does not make way over 50%, and most of them 100% of their living from agriculture. There's a farm implement dealer. There's the president of the independent bank in Hassel there. And each one of those people in the corner are involved in agriculture, and these are the people that we're talking about. My father's standing over there. With the exception of Pete Laney and Steve Carricker and myself, there are not any farmers in the House of Representatives that make their living out of agriculture. If you have some comments, if you'd really like to talk to the people that we're specifically pointing to, those ladies and gentlemen over there will be some very fine people for you to talk to. They're the ones that have the problem. And so I just wanted to bring that to your attention, that we're not just up here making these things up. They're very real, very deep-seated. I'm not saying they've got all the answers. I'm not telling you I've got all the answers. But if you'd like to speak with someone besides legislators that sometimes don't have the entire burden of their livelihood, those are some good people in the corner.
I'd like to. Rick, I'd like to follow up by saying that I'm a small businessman. I operate a retail store in Gatesville, which is in a rural agricultural district. The impact on my business with a decline in farm economy has just been incredible. I know all the farmers in my district. I know the ones that come into my store. They're just not coming in. There's no money available for them to come in and make the normal purchases that they traditionally do. So it's impacting not only banks, it's impacting in rural districts, and it's impacting every merchant that's working within that district that normally sells to farmers.
I'd like to introduce Representative Alex Moreno, who represents Valley District and has another perspective yet on the problems of the farm industry.
Sure. My area is a little bit different from some of the rest of them for two reasons. One, our agriculture is very, very diversified in the valley, and still, by and large, almost all of the farmers in our area are having trouble. There are a few sectors of the agricultural economy, sugarcane that I can think of offhand, that is doing well, and the rest of them, vegetable farmers, grain farmers, cattle raisers, everybody's doing terrible. The citrus has been devastated by a freeze of a couple of years ago. We've just got an emergency crisis conditions in our area. The other thing that makes it different from some of the other members' areas is that we have a great number of farm workers in our area who are dependent on agriculture. And when the farmers don't do well, the farm workers can't do well. Both from that perspective of farm workers and farmers, I certainly and the Valley Reps want to see something done in regard to giving the farmers a hand during this crisis that they're going through.
If we could change chairs here and get Robert Saunders, the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee. Robert's got a few comments to make.
I'd like to relate back to one of the questions that was asked. Are we passing the buck to the federal, on the federal level, saying that the state of Texas can't do anything? I really think that we're not really passing the buck. We are trying to tell Congress that we're interested in keeping farmers alive and out on the farm. But I think that the main thing that Texas can do is try to protect the things that we've gained so far. And in the past sessions of the legislature, we've had that ability to do that through exemptions and ag use value when the Pivoteau bill passed. But I think the basic thing is that we cannot subsidize the farming product enough to compete with many of the foreign markets. And I think that the real problem is that we need to find other means to keep those guys from surviving, to survive out in the fields. And hopefully with some of the loans that instead of just rolling interest each particular year and losing money, we need some protection so some of those farmers can stay in business.
This is a declaration of the legislature, but in order to get any kind of federal machinery working under what you've got, you need something from the governor, right, under the existing disaster and emergency and stuff like that. Y'all hit him up on just trying that.
Well, the situation goes beyond emergency relief. The credit problem is a symptom of a greater problem. It's not the foundation of the problem. The credit problem exists because the cash flow, the profitability is not there in farming. If farmers had the money to pay off the loans, they wouldn't need more loans. So the governor has power for weather-related emergencies, et cetera, but this whole problem goes beyond the scope of emergency legislation to cover. We have to cover this problem with foundation legislation, that is a farm bill itself.
We don't need more loans. We need cash money for a product.
Aren't you also finding, though, the general philosophy of the Reagan administration? I mean, this farm crisis is not a surprise to me, and I'm sure it's not a surprise to many people in the country. When Ronald Reagan says he's going to veto emergency farm aid, are you not afraid that the whole philosophy of the administration is let the farmers who can't make it die out and let's replace them with corporate farms?
At the outset, I said we were not here to play partisan politics. We have to work with the administration that we have, and we would hope that we can impress on that administration that a policy such as that will wreak havoc within the rural community, the agricultural community, the financial community, and the related business communities.
How will you convince them of that? Well, they don't seem to share, at least the administration right now doesn't seem to share that view.
I think that when Vice President Bush alluded to that veto and the legislature did not roundly applaud, where there was obviously a space for applause, that we began to send the message. And I hope that, in all honesty and sincerity, I hope that they received that message and treat it accordingly.
There was no applause during this period. You could say that about any message that they lost.
Maybe that's an education.
But really, the federal government is saying if we say yes to the farmers, we have to say yes to the next group that comes in, we have to say yes to the next group.
Well, let me reiterate that in a farm bill, we're not calling for government spending. We're calling for the government to help us manage our own production. Now that's what we're asking for, and it's not necessary to subsidize that production. Simply give farmers the tools they need to market. Manage their own production and the marketing of that production. Two quite different things.
Could you be more specific?
Sure. One of the big problems we have in agriculture is probably the primary problem we have in agriculture is that our productive capabilities outstrip our marketing capabilities. We don't have markets to absorb the products that we grow at a profitable price. We end up selling a lot of surplus commodities into the world market at a very low price. If we have programs which allow us as individuals to match that production roughly with the supply, then the market price will rise to a profitable level. That's primary in any farm bill, that we have some mechanism that allows us to do that. Any number of mechanisms can and have been designed. Any number of previous farm programs have worked to a lesser or greater degree to accomplish that. We've not had lately an administration which chose to administer farm law in such manner that allows the matching of production and demand.
Why can't you guys get anybody to listen? In '77, you had the big parity fight that had all the tractors and everything up in Washington. It died down for a while. Now we've got tractors rolling on Washington again, but it's basically the same battle and the same fight. Why is anybody listening?
I see a fundamental difference there. Farmers who came to Washington in 1977 were regarded as sort of clowns. They were treated as if they were asking for something unrealistic. It's quite different now. Those farmers are regarded much more the way that civil rights marchers 20 years ago were regarded, as having a genuine grievance and a genuine problem. I think the atmosphere has changed, and the difference is probably 500,000 farmers who've gone out of business between 1977 and 1984. Excuse me, I didn't see.
Are you going to run with this resolution today?
The resolution will be introduced and filed today. It'll have to go through the legislative process, so it's not out on the floor until...
Well, have you talked with the Speaker about it?
No, we haven't talked with the Speaker about this specifically.
Are you going to try to get emergency? I mean, suspending?
No intention to anything other than put it in the regular legislative mill, and we think we'll get the attention it needs and deserves. Ladies and gentlemen, I appreciate your coming today. If there are any further questions you have for me or any of the other members that are here, I'm sure we'll be glad to be available for those. We are going to session at 10 o'clock, so we better call a halt. Really?
You did good. Tidy. You really should minimally keep things closed. I happen to believe that there is justification from time to time for some things not to be open, for covert action. Somewhere between doing nothing and a declaration of war, I think it is in the national interest, and every president since George Washington, I think, has found this, to have availed oneself of covert action. But I think the answer to your question in terms of disclosure really stems from the numbers of people that are clued in on what's going on. After the 1975 exposés in the intelligence business, much more was done in terms of briefing, for example, briefing congressional committees and staffs in terms of theretofore very closely held covert actions. And I think that has resulted in some more disclosures. I think individuals who, out of conscience or some other reason, who leak information on covert action are part of the problem. So I think it's really the move towards more and more discussion in numbers of committees that are briefed. I happen to think that what would be a good idea would be a joint committee, very much like the Joint Atomic Energy Committee. There never used to be any leaks out of that. Liz would remember that. Never, ever. And I think it would be a good thing, and you still could have the proper oversight of the intelligence community. But when you're briefing 4 to 6 different committees, depending on whether you're talking about appropriations or intelligence, why, it's very hard to keep information of that nature quiet. And again, it's, you know, in terms of this support, some congressmen and senators are saying, I'd support this if you could do it openly. But then I would have to ask the University of Texas Law School to tell me how you can give the kind of support openly that without a, you know, total severance of relations and without some kind of a declaration of war. Maybe there is something, but we haven't located that. And yet I see what's going on in the real world in terms of support from the other side of these kinds of operations. And I think, well, the United States better not tie its hands totally when it comes to clandestine operation at secret intelligence and when it comes to carefully supervised covert action. The easiest thing to do is to go after the CIA. But the CIA
is obligated under the law, and I'm satisfied they're doing it, before anything of that nature is undertaken, to go through a presidential finding signed off on by the top people in the, you know, Secretary of State and Vice President and Defense Department and all of that, and then to brief those findings to these members of Congress. So I think it's easy for some to say, well, I'll go after the agency, but that isn't, you know, the fair thing to do if you don't like covert action. Come after the administration or Congress or somebody else.
What non-military action is the United States taking concerning Nicaragua?
Well, I'm afraid we're not taking any actions, but what I would like to do is see them move towards the, as in I think others in the Contadora process would, to see these good faith efforts come forward now, and when they materialize, I think we'd be back at the table, and I think we could be helpful. I outlined the parameters under which we would help, and then I think it would be economic aid, and that's what we should be doing and would be doing if we didn't have this distinct knowledge that they are pursuing a path that is anathema to anybody that respects democracy. So I would say that the place we should be giving support and would be, if these things can happen, would be economic aid, just as we are doing to other countries, far transcending, incidentally, the military support. I saw a report the other day by some congressional committee that said we were giving more military aid than we were economic to other countries in this hemisphere. That is not correct. The preponderance of the aid is economic. Sir.
Mr. Vice President, even as you asked for more aid for Nicaragua, Congress is rushing to provide more aid to the freedom fighters in Afghanistan. What is your position on supplying that much aid to them, specifically in supplying anti-aircraft cannon to the freedom fighters? And secondly, if we give them that much aid, what assurances do we have that that money is not going into the coffers of the Pakistani bureaucracy?
Well, I will not comment on what is going on in terms of your question. I simply won't answer that, because if I did, I might be guilty of violating my own premise on discussing matters that I don't feel at liberty to discuss. We are giving enormous amounts of humanitarian aid in Pakistan, and I am satisfied to Pakistan to support the refugees, and that's, I know this isn't responsive to your question, but I just don't want to respond to it. But in terms of being sure that aid is getting there, I think it is. I think we have very good satisfaction that aid is reaching the refugee camps in Pakistan. And you raise an interesting question, because people, objection to clandestine operations or covert operations depends on their selectivity as to what, not moral indignation about the fact of, but whether they like the recipients of it. And that's all I will say.
Mr. Vice President, recently the National Conference of Catholic Bishops sent representatives, I think three or four bishops, including the president of the conference, went on fact-finding missions both to Managua and to Cuba. And I just would like to know whether you and top-level members of the administration have plans to meet with these bishops and ask for their evaluation and opinion.
Absolutely.
On the state of the country.
I do, and I would expect, I don't, can't commit the president to who he meets with, but before Mr. Hickey went down there, I had lunch with him, and I'm very interested to see what Bishop O'Connor and the others say when they get back. Very interested. And the door is open, and I'd be most anxious to hear it, because I know they will be just as concerned as we are about what's happened to the church down there. Next, sir.
Mr. Vice President.
We have some, excuse me. We'll go here and then over here. I'm blinded.
That's all right. He's begun.
All right.
Please continue.
Are the dollars and cents and the technology that the administration is requesting to go into Central America going to be enough to accomplish what the administration wants to accomplish down there? Do we need to realistically be thinking about the idea of sometime in the future sending some troops down there to accomplish, as opposed to just the dollars and the technology?
Well, one, I think, would never say what one would ultimately do or not do, but we have a distinct aversion